Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Robert Scheer, who considers the resignation of Lawrence Summers, director of the White House National Economic Council, and the future direction of President Obama's economic policy. Lorella Scarborough, a resident of the Coal River Valley, West Virginia, who discusses the campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining and her project to build a wind farm to generate clean energy. And Denise Gray Felder, communications director with the One Nation Working Together March, who talks about the message that will be sent by tens of thousands of protesters expected in Washington, D.C. on October 2nd. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories. Since 2006, more than a dozen of Colombia's most notorious right-wing paramilitary leaders have been extradited to the United States to face drug trafficking charges. The extradition of the paramilitary kingpins surprised many Colombians and death squad victims who sought the truth in documenting 20 years of murders, assaults, and kidnappings. Outrage among the victims grew earlier this year when U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton blocked public access to seven paramilitary cases. According to the investigative website ProPublica, there is currently no way of knowing if the paramilitary leaders negotiated lighter sentences for cooperation with prosecutors. One defendant who was released on his own recognizance in Maryland has disappeared. These cases have raised red flags among American legal scholars about the practice of sealing entire court records and the power individual judges have to keep case numbers secret. Roxana Altools of the International Human Rights Clinic at the University of California at Berkeley, who represents the Colombian victims, says the U.S. government broke its promise to the victims' families, saying they would have full access to the American legal system. Meanwhile, human rights lawyers have identified an additional 25 cases of paramilitary leaders whose cases are now sealed by U.S. courts. While Western powers and the Islamic Republic of Iran have locked horns over Iran's nuclear program, pragmatists in Tehran have their eye on the South Caucasus, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, to boost economic and cultural ties. Last summer, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad had a well-publicized visit with Georgia's pro-American president, Mikhail Saakashvili, to promote economic and regional ties. Iran is seeking to build a $1.2 billion rail link between the two countries, expanding natural gas purchases from Azerbaijan and building a 200-mile oil pipeline from the Caspian Sea to the Middle East. According to Foreign Policy magazine, Tehran is also trying to prevent the United States from stationing a military base in the South Caucasus, a region of increasing importance to Western energy security. Iran shares its borders with Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, nations with high levels of American military operations. For Georgia, which has received $4.5 billion in Western aid since 2008, improving ties with Iran and other Middle Eastern countries is a matter of necessity, noted Alexander Rondelli of the Georgia Foundation for Strategic and International Studies. Rondelli observed, "Georgia cannot afford to alienate anybody. It is in Georgia's interest to keep Russia from having all the cards here." In 2008, environmental activists delivered the money, enthusiasm, and people power that helped elect Barack Obama to the presidency. 2 years later, with continuing unemployment and sagging poll numbers for the Democrats, green activists are being outfinanced and outworked by the energy industry and Tea Party activists. Meanwhile, moderate Democrats who took a risk in voting for a weak cap-and-trade climate change bill addressing energy usage and global warming in the House of Representatives are facing attack ads slamming what they call Nancy Pelosi's job-killing agenda. The funding for these anti-climate change ads comes from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Koch Industries, which is also bankrolling the Tea Party movement. Sierra Club Chairman Carl Pope says green activists are busy working to defeat Proposition 23 in California, which would repeal the state's progressive global warming law. Energy interests have already raised $8 million for the repeal campaign, including $4 million from Texas-based refiner Valero Energy Corporation. In Ohio, $171,000 has already been spent on anti-climate change ads in the district of Congresswoman Mary Jo Kilroy, who voted in favor of the House climate change bill. Most of the ads were paid for by the conservative group Americans for Prosperity, which is promoting a no-climate tax pledge. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Summers, director of President Obama's National Economic Council and his top economic advisor, announced that he'll resign at the end of this year to return to Harvard, where he's been both a professor and a former university president. When his departure was made public, President Obama thanked Mr. Summers for his service to the nation and said, "I will always be grateful that at a time of great peril for our country, a man of Larry's brilliance, experience, and judgment was willing to answer the call and lead our economic team." Summers, who served as Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration and was a mentor to Obama's current Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, is blamed by some observers for pushing the sweeping deregulation of Wall Street during the 90s that resulted in the current economic crisis. He's also culpable in the eyes of many for advocating for the Obama policy of bailing out giant U.S. banks with hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars, but getting nothing in return. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist Robert Scheer, author of the new book, The Great American Stick-Up, How Reagan Republicans and Clinton Democrats Enriched Wall Street While Mugging Main Street. Scheer explains his disappointment with President Obama's bank-friendly economic policies and expresses hope that Summers' departure might signal a more progressive and populist economic program in the remainder of his time in office.
He was a disaster in the Clinton administration. He was a protege of Robert Rubin, who had come to Clinton from Goldman Sachs, and it was basically Robert Rubin who had pushed through the reversal of the main New Deal legislation to prevent another depression, the Glass-Steagall Act. It was called the Financial Services Modernization Act. The use of the word modernization is a very good tip-off to when bad things are going to happen for consumers. And then his protege, Lawrence Summers, took over as Treasury Secretary and pushed through the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. And the first legislation allowed these too big to fail banks to develop, the merger of investment and commercial banking and insurance companies. And the second, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, provided what was called legal certainty to the newfangled derivatives that proved so toxic, the collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps. And what it said was, in Titles 3 and 4, very clear language, it said that no existing regulatory agency or regulations would apply to these financial futures that were based primarily on alt and prime, subprime mortgages and other suspect paper. No one could really understand them, but this was supposed to be the brave new world, and Lawrence Summers testified in numerous times before congressional committees that there would be, you know, if it went belly up, this would be a victimless crime. These are rich people, know what they're doing with their money. And in fact, just the opposite happened. And then inexplicably, he went to become an advisor to Obama after being president of Harvard. That was his first reward for failing, was made president of Harvard. And then he became an advisor to Obama after he ran into some difficulty at Harvard, challenging the ability of women to do math and science. And he was, while he was advising Obama, he made $8 million in those very months that he was advising Obama from hedge funds and speaking fees on Wall Street. And then Obama brought him in to fix the problem that he had as much as anyone created. And I think he just did all the wrong things. He basically followed the policy of George W. Bush and throwing money at Wall Street and getting nothing in return.
Robert, if you had President Obama's ear right now as he faces a possible loss of Democratic majorities in the House, if not the Senate, what would you tell him about Tim Geithner, who's the current Treasury Secretary, and the rest of his economic team? Should he start over again and put people in place who can address the popular anger out there at Wall Street, where it seems Obama has not heard that rising anger in the population?
Well, I think Obama should reintroduce himself to the previous Obama. I mean, as a candidate against Hillary Clinton in April of 08 at Cooper Union, he gave the best speech on what was happening with the economic meltdown. It's a speech I reproduce in, I think, in its entirety in The Great American Stick-Up, because I think it's really says much of what has to be said. He blamed the radical financial deregulation. He blamed both Clinton and Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush for this. And so it was bipartisan, his critique. And then, inexplicably, when he got more successful in the primaries and became the candidate, he turned to the very people who had engineered the whole Clinton meltdown. So I would say, yes, of course he has to get rid of Geithner, and I think it's very good that he got rid of Summers, and I would return to the people who were advising him as a candidate, you know, George Stieglitz and Paul Volcker, maybe Paul Krugman, I don't know. I mean, there's plenty of people who've got their heads screwed on right when it comes to the economy. He just didn't turn to them. And it's one of the great mysteries of the Obama administration. I mean, I'm one of those who had really great hopes for him, and I even contributed money that I didn't have at that moment because I was afraid he might lose towards the end. And, you know, I was just shocked after what he had said during the primaries that he turned to these very people. And I think, you know, well, it would have been great if they, in fact, reversed course and did something different, but they didn't.
Robert, recently President Obama appointed Elizabeth Warren to oversee the creation of a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He avoided a confirmation fight in the U.S. Senate. Is this a signal of maybe a new tack he's going to take on his economic policy, do you think?
Well, I'm so desperate for a new tack that I'll take any sign. But I'm afraid this is not that important a sign. And the problem with the Consumer Protection Agency, it's housed at the Fed, which was responsible for looking the other way during this whole run-up of toxic mortgages and the whole underfunding of AIG and everything. I mean, the Fed was not on the case. And you're having the head of it report to the Treasury Department. With Elizabeth Warren, at least if he had gone through a fight in the Senate to say, look, we need a strong consumer advocate, and she is. I mean, she is the best, and she's distinguished herself being head of the Congressional Oversight Committee, handling the bailout and everything. She's been terrific. And so if Obama said, look, here's where I draw the line, and yes, I'm going to put it to the Senate, and this is the person we need because she speaks for consumers and cares about the ordinary person, and I'm going to make this fight, and made her head of that agency, then I think we would have at least had a chance of some kind of protection. I'm afraid now it's you know, it's still better than nothing, but it might end up being window dressing.
That was journalist and author Robert Scheer. His latest book is titled The Great American Stick-Up. Scheer edits and writes for the online news magazine TruthDig.com. Over 1,000 activists from the Appalachian coal fields and their supporters met in Washington, D.C. in the last weekend of September for a two-day conference on how to stop mountaintop removal mining. The conference, titled Appalachia Rising, Voices from the Mountains, was followed by a march, rally, and acts of civil disobedience outside the White House, where more than 100 protesters were arrested. One of the conference speakers was Lorella Scarborough, a resident of Coal River Valley, West Virginia, whose coal miner husband died of black lung disease and whose home was threatened by a nearby mountaintop removal operation. Mountaintop removal is a method of coal extraction where explosives are used to blast the tops off mountains in order to get at the thin seams of coal underneath. The process has literally destroyed the landscape of the region and buried 2,000 miles of streams, creating air and water pollution that is making local residents sick. For the past 5 years, Scarborough has been working to build a wind farm to generate electricity atop Coal River Mountain. She spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who attended the Appalachia Rising Conference, about the destruction wrought by mountaintop removal coal mining, progress being made to build her wind farm, and the urgent need for a diversity of jobs in the impoverished region.
In early 2007, there was a wind feasibility study done for Coal River Mountain, and it showed that Coal River Mountain had amazing wind potential. It had a lot of between 4 and 7 wind feasibility, 4 being the minimum that you have to have in order to erect an industrial-scale windmill farm. By early 2008, we came together with Coal River Mountain Watch and At Voices and the Sierra Club and Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. A lot of groups partnered together in order to begin the Coal River Wind Campaign. And the primary purpose of the Coal River Wind Campaign was to first and foremost save that mountain, to keep that mountain intact, and to create renewable energy and green jobs, and to actually start rebuilding the area. Since we live at Mountaintop Removal, we're ground zero for Mountaintop Removal, and Coal River Mountain is probably the last fully intact mountain range within a 50-mile radius, or was the last fully intact mountain until Massey Energy started mining activity in late 2009. And so we mounted a campaign which showed that we could generate enough power on Coal River Mountain to power 70,000 to 80,000 homes. We could generate revenue for the county that would be above $1.7 million annually for the county. We could create 200 locally trained green jobs during the construction phase, a two-year construction phase. And forever, we could create 40 to 50 jobs on that mountain maintaining the wind farm. Every 20 to 25 years, the wind turbines would have to be replaced, which is another spike of employment. We had an economic feasibility study done for the area, and the economic feasibility study also showed that advocated for a wind turbine factory on Coal River as opposed to the expansion of coal mining. Now, while the Coal River Wind Project would erect an industrial-scale windmill farm on Coal River Mountain, we also advocated and believed that when we stopped, we still believe that when we stop mountaintop removal, there will be an increase in underground, traditional, responsible, room and builder coal mining jobs. At one time in the state of West Virginia, we had 125,000 coal mining jobs, and now we're down to about 17,000. And so mountaintop removal is not a job creator, it's a job killer. And what we want, what we desperately need in the Coal River Valley and throughout Appalachia, throughout the coal towns of Appalachia, is we need job diversity. One of the biggest obstacles in Appalachia is the fact that we have no choices. We live in a monoeconomy, and we have no choices. The only good-paying jobs there are in the industry. That's the way the industry likes it. That's the way the majority of our politicians like it. And for 120 years, we've been fighting to change things. And one of the things that I do on a regular basis, whether it's in my neighborhood, whether it's at the state capitol, or whether it's on Capitol Hill, there are some of us that have made the decision that we've lived our whole lives in Appalachia, in these little coal towns. We plan to spend the rest of our lives there. No matter what happens, they're not driving us out. And that is people in the environmental community and people in the coal industry. On both sides, we've made the decision that we will live and die there. And a small handful of us have made the decision that if we're going to stay there, we need to try to figure out what we can do to make that place a better place. And so we believe that job diversity is a major contributing factor to be able to continue to exist and live on the land that we love and be with the people that we love. You know, there's a song that says, which side are you on? And it's to the point now to where it doesn't matter which side you're on. We all love the same people. And the problem is we're all being used and none of us have any choices. When the fourth largest coal producer in the country decided to come in and blow the top off the mountain behind my house where my property borders Coal River Mountain, I no longer had a choice to stand by anymore and pretend like bad things weren't really happening. And the guys who work for the coal industry and a lot of the guys on the MTR sites don't feel as though they have any choices. You know, there's a limited number of jobs underground. That's the way the industry likes it. And it is a greater profit margin for the coal industry if they can access the coal by blowing the tops off the mountains. And that's why mountaintop removal exists. It's simply a greater profit margin for the coal industry. It makes me very, very angry for people who rape and pillage Appalachia, call themselves coal miners. I think that is it's an enormous insult to my husband, who spent 35 years as an underground union coal miner, and he died of black lung. He gave his life to the industry. And for somebody that is pushing a button and destroying everything around us and destroying the water source, covering over 2,000 miles of headwater streams, decapitating 500 mountains, to call themselves a coal miner makes me very angry.
That was Lorella Scarborough of Coal River Wind. Visit her organization's website at coalriverwind.org. and the conference website at appalachiarising.org. The response of people to the worldwide economic crisis varies from nation to nation. Here in the U.S., the most angry and vocal activists have been right-wing groups such as the Tea Party movement, which have called for dramatic cutbacks in government programs and dismantling the nation's frayed social safety net. They first gained attention last summer during protests against President Obama's modest health care reform proposal, later fueled by corporate donors and extensive coverage in the U.S. media. Tea Party candidates have since been victorious in key Republican Party primary battles to run for U.S. Senate seats. In contrast to America's anger on the right, seen most recently at conservative talk show host Glenn Beck's well-attended August 28th rally at the Lincoln Memorial, workers in Europe are mobilizing under a progressive banner. In France, more than a million striking workers marched in Paris in opposition to President Sarkozy's pension reform bill, which will increase the minimum retirement age to 62. Labor and progressive activists have organized a growing wave of coordinated strikes and protests in capitals across the continent, opposing government austerity measures with the slogan, "No to Austerity, Priority for Jobs and Growth." But a large coalition of U.S. progressive groups are now looking to make some noise of their own about the economic crisis and high unemployment, challenging the rhetoric of Tea Party activists. On Saturday, October 2nd, labor unions and civil rights groups will lead a march and rally in the nation's capital called One Nation Working Together, with the platform One Nation Working Together for Jobs, Justice, and Education for All. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Denise Gray Felder, communications director with the march, who discusses the message of the protest action and how it relates to this November's important midterm congressional election.
Well, the One Nation Working Together, which is a social movement made up of nearly 500 endorsing organizations, is hosting a march on Washington at noon at the Lincoln Memorial in D.C. And the purpose of the march is to focus, to help refocus our nation's priorities on jobs, justice, and public education. The three things that we believe are most important for our country to reinvest in and refocus on at this point in our history.
And maybe you could talk about some of the groups that initiated the call to march under the banner of the One Nation Working Together theme.
Well, One Nation Working Together is a movement of people from all backgrounds, faiths, and hues. It ranges from labor unions and civil rights and human rights organizations to youth groups, to faith organizations, to non-believers, to environmental organizations, immigration organizations, peace organizations, and everything in between, I like to say.
Was it the NAACP and SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, that got the ball rolling here?
Well, the two men who had the original idea for the march were the president of the NAACP and the president of 1199 of SEIU, yes.
What is the platform of the march? What's the message you want to have echo across the nation from the people gathered in Washington?
Well, we want the people to come together to sort of reclaim our fundamental right to the American dream. And we're defining the American dream in terms that makes sense for the average working person, for the average working family. That means the ability to have a job that's a secure job, allows you to take care of your family, allows you to prepare for your future, and to give your children access to a quality education.
Denise, as I know you're well aware, there's been much media coverage of the march, contrasting it with Glenn Beck, the right-wing radio talk show and TV host, in his rally back on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28th. How do you respond to the idea that this is somehow a counter to Glenn Beck's rally or not?
Well, first of all, I say absolutely it is not a counter to Glenn Beck's rally, because the One Nation Working Together movement actually was in motion as long ago as the spring, sort of late March, early April. The idea for both the movement as well as the march sprung up. So we've been planning this for some time. And so definitely it's not in response to Glenn Beck's march.
How does this march, if at all, relate to the November 2nd midterm congressional election, which, you know, a lot of people are thinking could see power change in Washington in the Capitol, which could mean a dramatic effect on the issues that you're marching for?
Well, clearly, one of the things that we want to have happen starting October 3rd and carrying, you know, forward is for people who care about these critical issues of jobs, I like to say jobs, more jobs, and secure jobs, for them to really vote for candidates in the midterm elections that we all believe are supportive of those issues of jobs, justice, and public education. So we would like for people to take the same energy and the same mobilizing skills that they've used to get to Washington on Saturday and march into the voting booth on November 2nd. And after voting, we want people to remain engaged and to stay committed to holding the people that we vote for accountable. So that will continue way into 2011 and beyond, hopefully.
Denise, how would you contrast the message that's going to be going forth from the One Nation Working Together rally to what we've seen develop over the last year or so of these Tea Party protests, where it seems like there's a lot of negative scapegoating and blaming, you know, this group or that group? How would you contrast it?
Well, I would say that One Nation Working Together is really about moving beyond the divisiveness and the hate that seems to have really overtaken a significant segment of our national discourse. And many of the people that are involved in One Nation Working Together are just tired of that. I mean, we're fed up of people trying to tear us apart at a time when we should really be putting our country back to work and pulling our country back together. So we really have little patience for those who don't want to work together and don't want to focus on the commonalities that we have as people living in this country, as Americans. There's just a huge mass of people that are ready to help move this country forward.
That was Denise Gray Felder, Communications Director with the One Nation Working Together March, set for Saturday, October 2nd in Washington, D.C. Contact the march organizers at area code 202-263-4568 or visit their website at onenationworkingtogether.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.